This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Michael Martin, Michael Rowe, and Andy Piper. This is your weekly podcast about gamification, gaming technology, and play. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, not of any organization which we have been, are, or will be affiliated.
This is episode 324, with glorious purpose.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the metaverse, humans, in the metaverse, in the multiplicity of different realities, we welcome you. This is Andy Piper, and we welcome you to GamesAtWork.biz. This is our little podcast in our little podcasting corner of the universe, where we talk about all things exciting to us and hopefully to you around gaming technology, virtual worlds, social, internet, web, all kinds of cool stuff. And this week I am super unhappy to miss our friend Mr. Michael Rowe, but I am super excited to hang out with just the two of us, Mr. Michael Martin. Michael, how are you?
I am doing fabulously, thank you so much, or gloriously. Excellent. Perhaps even, you know, so you know, you never know, right? I miss Michael as well, but we're gonna have some fun here, and we hope for you, our listening audience, you will too. So, you know, take note of the things that we're going to share with you, and if they tickle your fancy or remind you of something, shoot over our way the things that you're reminded of. We're going to start off today with some bots. Last week we had a little bit of robotic intrigue. The first one, and this is a little unfortunate, because as I'm looking at the show notes and what we'll be sharing here, apparently Popular Mechanics would love for you to sign in and get unlimited access to check everything out. So my apologies for that in advance. But this article that came across our interwebs talks about the Slothbot. And the Slothbot, while this is not a brand spanking news story, the image of it was just super cool, of having something in the tree canopy hanging by a wire, moving around only as necessary to recharge the solar cells, and being able to become one with the rainforest and observe.
Yeah, this is really cool. We should be straightforward here. This story actually is probably from about a year ago originally. So I don't know how current this is, especially given lockdown and all the things that have changed in the last 12-18 months. But this is the Atlanta Botanical Garden, where they were testing Slothbot. As Michael says, a slow moving and an energy efficient robot that hangs out like a sloth on a wire. Just kind of hangs out, checks stuff out, monitors animals, plants, the environment, and it's really cool. It's a physical, you know, we talk a lot about bots on the internet and you know, virtual bots and virtual assistants and software. This is a hardware bot. This is a robot. I love, I'm reading a story in GA Tech that we'll also link to in the show notes. And it's talking to one of the professors at the Georgia Tech School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Slothbot embraces slowness as a design principle. You know, robots are typically today designed to be, you know, as human/mammal-like as possible, right? So people are trying to solve like the locomotion problems that mammals physically have solved in their biological bodies. This little dude is just hanging on a wire. He just moves around when he needs to move around. And I think it's brilliant. It's really cool. I'm really curious to know, given that this is a year old story, actually, although it has come up through different sources again recently, how active Slothbot is, what the outcomes have been, because that's something I haven't seen here. It's a kind of a research project, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this Popular Mechanics article was a May article from this year, but you're right. It's been around for a while, and maybe it just moves so slow, and we're conserving so many words about Slothbot that
there we go.
You know, only now are people beginning to even talk about it more. But we've talked about batteries. We've talked about the importance of power and being ready and able to get your power. So the intriguing thing to me about all this guy was that he only moves in order to reposition his solar cells or maybe to get a better look at something he's observing. But you can do it super slowly. And when you're in nature, you don't want to spook the things that you're trying to observe. And if you're just a remote camera on the ground, your batteries or your solar cell or whatever would eventually run out.
Exactly.
You know,
let's not upset our friendly natural friends in the environment.
Yeah, let's do what we need to do. So now if we're in the natural environment in a place like, say, Amsterdam, not now because they're still in test mode, but soon you might be in a sustainable way to get around in the canals because there will be boats that will take you where you need to go. And that can use the canals to get where you need to go, and to do all this via AI and boating robotics. I think they actually called them rowboats, in that sense.
Rowboats. So autonomous boats that can noodle around the canals in Amsterdam. I mean, Amsterdam is well known as a quite wet city in the sense that it has canals. This is really cool. I don't know whether you have this or I'm sure some cities in the US do have this. In London, we have, they're not autonomous, but we have electric boats that you can hire. And as a group of, I think, you know, 2 to 6. They're really cool. So there's one company that goes around the canals in the center of London around Paddington, and then there's another one which actually goes quite close to where I live in Kingston upon Thames, over to sort of, you can go over to Hampton Court or up to Richmond, and they're electric, so you know they're quite sustainable, quiet, easy to drive, no sails required,
no needing to tack,
exactly. This is interesting, and it is a different angle on autonomous cars, and you know how you might. I'm sure they've had to think about the challenges of driving the boats around, but potentially with maybe less. I don't know what you think in terms of maybe less challenges in terms of, you know, avoiding other vehicles, following all the road rules, etc. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not a boater. do you think this is more complicated or less complicated than autonomous cars?
My sense, it's just different, right? Yeah. So when you're moving at boating speed, you're probably going to encounter things like, oh, I don't know, perhaps a duck, right? And you don't necessarily want to mow down the duck or the dock or, you know, anything else that could be in the water. There could be flotsam and jetsam that you wouldn't necessarily see on the surface of a road. And because the way the light refracts off it, the AI has got to be able to cater for those things. And, you know, maybe the right answer is, well, you wait and let it float on by and then you go again, which is
makes a ton of sense. A different
thing you think of from a car. So
right,
it's a neat set of constraints that have to be worked out. And if you contemplate how machine learning and AI do what they need to do, that is what they do, right? They're like, oh, here's something new. What should I do in response? And did it work? And maybe it did, and maybe it didn't. And I'll try something else. So,
and of course, the physics of, you know, navigating a boat, like literally a boat on water, navigating through water is different to a car on solid asphalt, right? So I'm sure there's a ton of other things to figure out there as well.
Yeah, I mean, ice is a different consideration if you're in a waterway than if you are on a road, for example. So couple of interesting things like that. Well, look, sticking with the AI side of the house, there was another interesting article. This one in from The Guardian about an Italian artist who, and this is Magliani.
Carry on. No, keep going. Yeah. Try again. Keep saying it until we get there.
Until we get there. But
Modigliani. I don't think, maybe, I don't know, I probably screwed it up as well, but Modigliani.
Yeah, we got to say in Italian, come on, and use your hands. I didn't use my hands.
Modigliani.
So in 1917, he had produced a portrait of a girl, that was the name of this particular piece of art. And only recently have there been some x-rays and reviews and deep look at what's behind the painting as it exists today to discover that there's a painting behind the painting. And we've heard plenty of stories about this sort of thing. AI is going to be crucial to helping us find some of these patterns, and that might be very, very faint to begin with, and then fill in the missing pieces, what color or brushstroke or whatever might have been there, because many of these artists just didn't have the financial wherewithal to have parchment after parchment to do new drawings. Absolutely. They would paint over an existing one and do something what they would think might be better.
This was produced in the early 20th century, but of course the same technique, you know, artists painting over canvases has been a thing for centuries. This particular one is really interesting because of the way that this was discovered, and, you know, it's an x-ray and an analysis, and they had to sort of train specific algorithms to figure out what that image would have looked like was previously. But I've certainly seen some other similar things where much older paintings have been discovered to have other examples underneath. But this is fascinating for sure. X-ray, AI, looking at what came before. It's
so
really
so
fascinating.
Let me be intriguing for a moment, Andy. Mm. So here's the intriguing thing. What if there are a way to monetize this? What if there are a way to say, hey, we discovered this painting underneath this painting. It's now an NFT, a non-fungible
token.
Here
we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And mm-hmm. then we're going to now create, well, we're not creating art. It was created, but we've uncovered it. We've discovered it. So wouldn't it stand to reason that the painting that was painted over still is a piece of art, still has value and worth, and it's only now been uncovered and should have some value to it.
And you're playing devil's advocate, but I think from the artist's perspective, the purpose of, you know, they probably are not that thrilled. We are interested from a historical perspective to learn where they've come from and what they did and things they may have noodled on previous to producing mm-hmm. the final artwork on the canvas. But, you know, if it was you or me, let's say,
yeah,
we write a lot of documents, we write a lot of emails, we
delete
coding every now and then. Yeah, we delete a load of, you know, stuff as we get to the thing that we're happiest with.
Yeah.
How thrilled would we be if in a 200 years time people said, well, this guy Michael Martin, you know, sent this document to his boss, but actually, you know, the previous version was this. And I'm going to, that should be an NFT. And I'm going to make money off that. You probably, you know, from a legacy perspective, and we'll talk more about legacy later, but that probably wouldn't be your end game, right? So I have some sympathy for the artists. I'm fascinated, as I some listeners may not know, my major in degree is history. So I am fascinated by the process of how humans creatively get from A to B. But and some of those pieces of art, maybe when we're looking at paintings in particular, maybe themselves objectively or subjectively interesting, but they were not what the creator intended to be presented. Now we this goes down all kinds of interesting rat holes in terms of digital recreation of movie stars, and you know, retrospectively changing films or stories or other things. And all of those are somewhat layers on layers of a painting, right? George Lucas. Some things are exactly, Michael. Some things are irrevocable. Hand shot first.
Yep.
Jabba the Hutt was not in episode 4. What the hell? Anyway.
Well, where I was going was, if you imagine a sculpture, right? And I don't remember who said that the purpose of the sculptor was freeing the art from within the stone, right? Or the wood, right? In theory, you could have a piece of art that then is irrevocably changed to create the next piece of art out of it, if you're a sculptor, right? In the case of literature, right? Certainly there are revisions. And as we look at the first revisions of Tolkien's books and see what was changed and what happened here and why, you know, there's some things that are really intriguing. Shakespeare is a great another example of lots of ink spilt on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The ownership rights of a painting here. Right. So here we have an artist who is long gone from this world, shuffled off the mortal coil, so to speak. And would you think maybe that the current owner of the artwork, which has the prior artwork underneath it and visible, is now the owner of said artwork? Or do the rights revert back to the estate of the artist, because they never sold that? They sold visible,
right? They arguably never produced, well, they did obviously physically produce that, but they arguably never published, quote unquote, published and produced that.
There's
so many questions here. We need to move along, I think, because otherwise we're not going to get through some of the other stories we have this week. But there's so much to unpack in that whole story.
So thank you for along,
thank you for confusing me completely.
That's my aim. That's my aim. that and fact checking. So if we move into perhaps a series of twisty tunnels, we have a game here that appears, according to our Facebook friends, this is something you found to be an awesome test for artificial intelligence. Yeah.
So NetHack or Rogue or, I think it goes by some other names as well, but certainly I've always known it as NetHack. For those of you as old as Michael and I, it's an ASCII-based, auto-generated, procedurally generated dungeon game, which originally, back in the day, before fancy graphics came along, you were just a little at symbol.
At sign.
And you would like, you know, literally, you know, use the cursor keys or WASD to move around and beat up, you know, goblins and other things.
Kestrels,
all kinds of horrible things that would try and destroy you, and get lots of treasure. Facebook's AI division have suggested that, you know, we've solved chess. From an AI perspective, we've solved Go, which is known as an extremely difficult, clever problem. But both of those games both have an end, right? They There is a winner at the end of it, and it's yep. you know
the game
person
is over.
Against person, and the game is over. But because this is procedurally generated, because there are so many different possibilities, that NetHack could be a really good target for some kind of advanced AI to go digging into from a machine learning perspective. And you know, the story that we're reading in TechCrunch describes it as the notoriously difficult and infinitely complex NetHack. It's if you play the very basic version just in ASCII characters, it looks super simple, but it's actually, from my perspective, it always was, mm-hmm. you know, quite engaging, because I'm into Dungeons and Dragons and those kind of things. And trying to get a computer to, like, think how a human thinks in that perspective, especially as a single player game with no end, no defined end, it's fascinating. I think it's really interesting. And I think they may not be completely wrong in terms of the challenge, right? I think it is a really interesting challenge, and I'll be interested to see what emerges and whether anybody comes up with a model that enables that game to be played programmatically against a procedurally generated endless dungeon. That would be really cool, interesting.
Well, one of the neat things about machine learning games being applied towards games like this is that you wind up deriving rules that perhaps weren't ever really intended to be rules. And one of the things that was striking me about this, and I played a lot of Rogue in my day, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I have it on my iPhone too, incidentally. So I from time to time.
Original ASCII?
Not the original ASCII, but
yeah, it's got
different models, so I like to stay on the ASCII version.
You're not a purist, Michael.
Well, look, my my PC Junior or whatever is no longer operational.
I'm joking.
That was before we actually used colors too. You know
what? I know. And then there were only four color. Well, there were two colors, and there were four anyway. Yeah.
Oh yeah, big time stuff. So
Grandpa.
Two thoughts. Thought number one, which is where I was going, is you start to discover there are the AI discovers rules that maybe weren't intended. And one of the interesting things about this game is you don't win, right? You just try to stay alive as long as you can,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
You need to get food to stay alive. You need to avoid the monsters to stay alive, etc. And you progress the game by going deeper and deeper into the dungeon so that you can get more level ups and potions and scrolls and all that kind of good mm-hmm. stuff. What if, do you suppose, Andy, having played this game once or twice yourself, that a la War Games, the computer determines that the best way to win the game is never go downstairs. You live forever.
Yeah, never leave the village.
Never leave the village, right?
Just go into the inn, have a beer, never go down the dungeon. Yeah, why not?
You know, easy peasy, right?
Brilliant.
Now, that's if you decide that the win condition is staying alive as long as possible, because, you know,
well,
typically I would
yeah.
play the game, you fall into a trap, you land in a spot that's got lots of Z and V, you know, the later you go in the alphabet, the stronger the characters usually were.
That's right.
And then they just gang up on you.
And then uppercase, kobolds, lowercase K, kobold, and capital K, something else, but horrible and going to kill you. Yeah.
So that was thought one. Thought two, and it just struck me as you were speaking, Andy, on all this, was the at sign. Where have we seen the at sign show up? Right. This is before you had at signs involved in email addresses and the like, right?
Absolutely.
So could this have been an influencing factor for people in the early days? Maybe so. Who knows?
Yeah, people can't see this because we're on video and this is an audio podcast, but I am making a expression on the video. Interesting.
All right. Next thing, also interesting about taking out your opponents. This popular mechanics article was one that I noticed, and it looks like, yes, you were able to go into it very well. So that's cool. talks about drones and anti-drone technology. So if you were managing a convoy, for example, and you wanted to make sure that you were not observed by hostile drones or drones with payloads that you don't want approaching your convoy and the like, you might design something to say, keep these other drones away from me. And we've seen solutions like nets and other things like that, or drones that do kamikaze style, you know, things. But this particular article talks about using silly string, or, well, not really using silly string, but for those of you who don't know what silly string is, it's this can of stuff that when you spray it, it just sprays all this string out. And if you are a little rotor driven autonomous vehicle, and that stuff gets stuck to your blades, you're not going to stay airborne for long.
I mean, it's a feature of the U.S. military, and I can't really argue with it. If it's effective, Michael,
if it works.
I mean, hopefully it's being used. I mean, the example here is being used on other autonomous drone type opponents. But yeah, it's interesting to see different ways that these unmanned systems can disable one another, or, you know, combat one another without, you know, ammunition as such. So
yep. You know. So that was the design point for this. It had to be safe to be used in civilian areas,
right.
So that you didn't harm people, civilians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. So in the world of new tech, another article came through, and we found one that we can link to and share and show with you too. This is about the alleged, we're staying on Facebook here for a little bit, the alleged Facebook technology coming out with a watch.
Yeah.
And some of the notions around it. What was your take on this?
I would love. So the general notion here is that should Facebook come out with a watch, it would have a couple of cameras for shooting and sharing photos, but one of which would always be looking at you. So every time you raise your wrist to check out presumably whatever notification or access whatever app, or just check the time, which, to be fair, I don't use my watch for very often. I have an Apple Watch, but I am generally using it for notifications. I don't necessarily want it to see my expression or be monitoring me or so on. So, look, I don't know. Facebook have tried a few things. They've tried sort of trying to take over the home screen on Android a number of years ago. And, you know, put the chat faces and everything and, you know, become the phone. They've got the portal, and I believe the portal's relatively successful. Do not use it myself. Do not have one myself. Can see the value of it, but I have other devices that enable me to keep in touch with my family and friends through other means, and do not need a portal. And obviously they have the Oculus. Look, so, and I own one of those, and I will not deny that I own an Oculus, and I sign into my Oculus Quest 2 with my Facebook account. Therefore, when I'm using it, they know that I'm using it, and presumably can at any point know the direction my head is facing and the games I'm playing and so on, or who I might be chatting to. I'm curious about the watch. I think they've tried to do a ton of stuff around activity tracking, or syncing activity tracking into Facebook to, you know, get more data, presumably. I have nothing against Facebook. I use Facebook every day, multiple times a day, but I'm not certain that a hardware device, especially a watch, is something that is useful, and it's not something that, certainly not something that I think I would buy, because I have other things in my life. But that doesn't mean that our audience, our listeners, other people in the world, people who are not in the same ecosystem as I, you know, wouldn't choose to use it.
Absolutely fair. And I think that was certainly a comprehensive thought around it. The thing that struck me initially was, of course it's going to have two cameras, right? Of course, right? Because if you're going to have a video conversation with someone, wouldn't it make sense that they could see you? So that was the thing that kind of...
That's Dick Tracy, though, right?
Exactly.
And Apple haven't put yet, and I'm not saying they won't and or never will, but they haven't yet put a camera into their watch. Mm-hmm. I'm certain that they could do it if they wanted to.
Sure.
And they could either use it for Dick Tracy style video calls. He said, literally raising his wrist to look at my watch as I speak to Michael, or something on the edge that would let me go ba-chink and take a picture, you know, 20 meters away. Or maybe that will happen. But I think, look, listeners to the regular listeners to our show know that we are Apple fanboys, frankly. And I can see a continuity to the ecosystem that Apple is building around their devices. I feel like this is potentially a very scattershot thing from Facebook's perspective if it happens. Personally wouldn't choose it. Could be cool.
Yep.
If people tell them suddenly it becomes a big thing in 2 years' time and everybody's wearing one, then hell yeah, I'll probably buy one because that's what I do. I'm an absolute tech geek. So
awesome. All right. Well, let's move on because we've got a couple more things that we want to touch before we close today. So speaking of our Apple fandom, and we're going to reserve the main conversations over some conference that was going on this week when Mr. Rowe is back with us in full power. But a couple of things that were intriguing or funny. Well, we'll do the intriguing one first, is the idea about a new feature that Apple's rolling out for legacy contacts. That we've talked about this kind of thing before too, about your digital footprint and the importance of having passwords and accessibility to all of that were you to become incapacitated or permanently incapacitated. Where does it go? How does it work? Where is it used for? And the folks at Apple have put some thought into all this, and they are creating a capability in iOS 15 that will allow you to do more than just say, in case I'm no longer here, here's my passwords.
Yes, I remember going to an event in London about 6 years ago where with a company that had literally sprung up in order to sort of own the digital legacy space, so that you could sign in to it, connect all your accounts to it, and then essentially delegate, you know, your next of kin / your legacy keeper, your the person that you know might execute your will. It's interesting. I know that other companies have done this. And some of the social platforms have already enabled it themselves. It's interesting to see Apple sort of building it into their, again, their ecosystem, right? Their platform.
And making it easy for people in the ecosystem to be able to use that for other people in the ecosystem.
It always interests me that it's a company that is making consumer products, right? So we are in tech. We think about things from a technical perspective. But the majority of people who buy their products, and the same applies to Android and Google and Facebook and other platforms, really don't care about the tech, right? Do not care how scalable this thing is and how it all works under the surface. They just want a device that works and it does all the stuff they want, and they want to be able to arguably hand over their legacy to somebody else. I'm not sure. It's interesting. It's iOS 15, so it's coming in the next version of iOS later in the year. I'm sure a lot of people will start to think about it. It's good to see Apple building it in. I thought that a lot of the stuff, and we don't have time to talk about a lot of the stuff that was announced this week at the Apple Developer Conference, I thought a lot of it was very incremental, but very cool. And again, I'm sure Mr. Rowe will educate us another week.
And have a deep perspective. And he's blogging about it, too. So throw a little bit of that into the show notes.
Talking of throwing.
Talking about throwing and catching.
Talking about throwing and catching. There's a very cool, and this is a super quick hit, and it is very visual and audio, so you need to follow the link in the show notes to get the most of this. Craig Federighi, who's the head of Apple operating systems, essentially, there's a really cool segment in the presentation this week where he catches an iPad and starts talking about, you know, all the new stuff coming. Somebody's done this to toe-tapping music, which is pretty
Jonathan
funny.
Jonathan Mann,
exactly. Exactly.
And if you're super cautious and you watch the WWDC keynote all the way to the end, you'll notice that there's a line that says, "No iPads were harmed in the making."
I hadn't seen that. That's cool. Love it. Amazing.
Love that. We've talked about old and new tech and potential tech, but there's one that's just about to hit the shelves, virtual shelves, so to speak, and that's Playdate. That we were trying to place how long ago was it that we talked about it, wasn't it?
We must have talked about this a couple of years ago.
Oh, we did.
Certainly,
I know we
as
did.
A product, it's been trailed. It's a company called Panic. It's a deliberately what they call 2-bit black and white graphics, simple games console in very bright yellow with a beautiful black and white screen. But the really cool thing about this is the really cool thing and intriguing thing about the Playdate that elevates it beyond sort of a Game Boy Switch, you know, handheld, is that it has this side crank. And when I say crank, it's like literally like a lever that you can literally turn. And I'm, again, it's one of those visual things that you can't see because I'm on a video and I'm talking to Michael and we're talking to you in audio. But that if you imagine your right hand on the side of the device might pick up a lever and literally rotate it back to front in order to do interesting things in the games. So that's really cool. And it's a really like quirky piece of hardware in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes with, I think they're kind of time limited games and they're like season games in seasons or something like that, if I remember rightly.
Well, they're going to give them for free, as yeah. I thought. And
well,
they
I mean,
say
after you've paid the $179 for the actual device, I mean, yeah, but yeah, I mean, you get 25 games.
Yep.
For the season. And then I think, you know, I don't know whether they're charging for future seasons. But one of the cool things in this week's update, which is essentially to announce that pre-orders are opening in a month or so, is that they've also designed with their design partners this really cute little dock that you can attach the Playdate to the front of. It's a Bluetooth speaker, so it will immediately give you stereo when you may be using the Playdate on the dock. It's a stand. It looks like a kind of old-timey TV, just not as bulbous. You know, if you think of these sort of 1950s rounded TVs, similar to the Time Variance Authority in Loki, if you're watching the new Marvel show. See how I did that?
Snuck that one in there.
See how I did that? Anyway, you know, it's really cute. And the really funny thing is that they kind of said, well, you know what? Not only is it like a charging stand, it's magnetic, it's a Bluetooth speaker, but we've got this space at the back, so let's just make it a pen holder. So they just literally stuck a hole in the back and, you know, they were like, yeah, and we'll make the pen the same color. So you can buy this, you know, dock with a pen that sticks in the back. It's brilliant. It's really funny.
It's super funny. 2019 is when this was first.
Was it? Okay, so a couple of years. So they've done pretty well.
And pre-orders are to begin in July. So if you find that you cannot live without one of these, that's your opportunity to
$179, black and white,
down some bucks. Has a crank.
Do it.
All right. So finishing off our show for the week here, you know,
as
we love us some Lego. In the
exactly,
show.
The best place to stop. Yes.
Holy moly! This typewriter
Isn't this cool?
is just something else. So the green is amazing. The
couldn't fact you, that you just press see, a key... couldn't you just see at the front of that typewriter instead of system where it's got this little logo, you could say IBM. Yeah. Oh,
you could.
No, it's you could. It's brilliant. It's a Lego ideas set.
Yep.
And I honestly, a lot of my favorite Lego sets have come from ideas in the last couple of years. This is I won't say working typewriter, because clearly, you know, it doesn't necessarily type, but it emulates, and it has, you know, as Michael was saying, keys that you can depress, and mm-hmm. that will push forward the bars to put things, you know, the Lego arms onto the typewriter ribbon.
At least one of them. It looks like one is articulated and maybe the rest are there for show.
I said to my wife that I am almost willing to put bets on how long it takes for someone to put an Arduino or Raspberry Pi inside this thing and have it operate as a real like USB
printer.
Keyboard. Or no, USB keyboard, right?
Oh. Just,
right?
Oh.
You could, yeah. you know, I can imagine like whenever you press those keys down, yeah, okay, fine. The arms for the what do you call those things? The arms for the yeah. We're both too young. But I reckon that you could put some actuators in there and figure out like which button is pressed and then push that through to a USB cable and tell the computer Michael is typing hello world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I reckon that's going to be one of the first hacks for this. This doesn't come out until next week. No, it comes out in July. It comes out next week for Lego VIPs like me. I am probably going to order one of these because it looks beautiful. It just looks beautiful. It would look great on my shelf in my office. I don't need it at all, but it looks beautiful.
Yeah, I love the keys. I love the fonts. You know, it's just a gorgeous thing. So when I saw this, it was like, yeah, this has got to be in the show. And the article that we're referencing here also, you know, does suggest that you could probably put a little ink on the yes. two-piece Lego there, and you get colons. You get lots of
amazing.
Colons.
Amazing, yeah.
As you work your paper through it. All right, well, friends and neighbors, glad you stuck with us for this show. We hope you come back for yet another. And we're looking forward to your ideas, things Lego or otherwise, that you're seeing, hearing, thinking about. They could be bots. They could be AI. They could be just about anything. Drop
it us
a line.
They could be about games at work, for goodness sake.
Could be.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk about them here next week on gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.